But it's not. BC, HDMI.
How many are beyond the courses?
Sorry? Uh-huh, it's working. Sorry,
how
what did you...
students are we in that courses?
Oof, 60. There are many students, but there are some students online and some students coming here physically. But yeah, that's general problem here. So not many people attend the classes because our video is too good. So you feel as if you were in the classroom, but it's not the same. You will see. Those that are physically present have an advantage. Yeah. Okay, we shall see. Last time we talked about time optimization of application of search algorithms in SNORT. Today we continue with optimizations, but now we talk about space optimization. So how do we implement vectors and matrices? Now, of course, these stories are general and they are applicable anywhere, but this is just an illustration that it has been taken into account to improve the implementation, efficiency of the implementation in SNORT as well. So some general methods. Now, what you have to observe is that the matrices that are used in SNORT are sparse. Now, if you have sparse matrices, there are many methods how to implement them in memory efficiently in order to occupy as few memory cells as possible. These matrices, they actually correspond to the function delta that we discussed last time when we talked about DFA implementation, and also the function G, the matrix if you have looked at the materials from the exercise, you have observed that you have a lot of these fail cells in the matrix that only have F value. It's like zero, so they are not used. And because of that, we should avoid occupying memory for them. So how can we do that? Each row corresponds to the current state of the machine, if you remember, and each column corresponds to the input symbol, and then in the cell, you put the next state. As we said, only a small number of input symbols compared to the size of the alphabet cause non-failure transitions in most cases. Because of that, the matrix is sparse because it contains a lot of fail values in the NFA case and a lot of zeros in the case of DFA. So, if you implement the matrix as is, it will be just wasting of memory. How can we save memory? We can use special forms of representing sparse matrices, and the requirement is okay, we are going to save some memory, but at the same time, we should not increase significantly the time complexity of this, because all these algorithms, they require some computation, and this computation should be not so time-consuming in order not to reduce the time efficiency, which is actually critical. It's more critical than the memory efficiency. In SNORT AHO-Korosek implementation, it is required that random access to the elements of the matrix should not include any search because search is time consuming. So, in ordinary matrix, if you want random access, you provide the row and the column, and at the crossing there is the value that you need. Now, if you use some of these algorithms for saving space, you will see that sometimes it will be required to find something in a row, for example. And that requires search, so this should be reduced or avoided if necessary. Now, what they chose for snort is so-called bandit row format. If you have a lot of zeros in a row, then you can encode the row in a special way in order to ignore the zeros preceding the first non-zero element and the zeros that follow the last non-zero element. So it is possible to do, and that's what they have done. So that's called bandit row format. So how to encode sparse matrices relatively efficiently. So first of all, what is the bandwidth here? It's the number of elements of the vector, which is a row of the matrix, between the first and the last non-zero element. And of course, all inclusive. So the first non-zero and the last non-zero are included. Some of the elements between these two can be zero, but we cannot avoid that, so we keep them. Of course, in the NFA case, fail is the same as zero. In the bandit row format, the first number is the bandwidth. So how many elements are there between the first non-zero and the last non-zero in that row? The second number is the index starting from one of the first non-zero element of the vector. Then we list the bandwidth elements of the vector, and that's it. And of course, this is all story, but here is how we do it. Suppose that one of the rows of the matrix is, you see, you have five leading zeros that we would like to avoid, and you have trailing zeros, six of them, that we would like to avoid. So we know that they are zero, so we don't have to store them. In between, we have these nine elements, 7, 0, 2, 8, 1, 0, 0, 0, 4. Okay? So we would like to keep, of course, in addition to all these, as few elements as possible. So we have actually two more. The first one is the bandwidth. Okay, so how many non-zero between the first non-zero and the last non-zero? So it's nine, so we already counted them. And the second additional number that we have is where is the first non-zero? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So that's the one. And the rest is, of course, the content. So we don't touch these elements between the first non-zero and the last non-zero. So instead of 20 elements here, so 5 here, 6 here, that's 11 plus 9, that's 20, we actually keep only 11 values. So we have saved almost half of the elements of this row. So that's the idea. That's called the bandit row format. So the first number here is called the bandwidth. And the starting index is the second number. Now, the question is, okay, it is easy to address the elements in this original row because we just provide which row and then we say which column. And that's it. Now, how do we do that in this reduced format? And here is how we do it. So if the original vector is v1, v2 to vn, where n is the dimension of the vector, in this case it was 20. Okay? Now v prime is the bandwidth, the initial position, and then these elements, v1 to vb. B is the bandwidth. So 9 in our case, so these are not touched. So we have b and I, the first two elements. And now I is the index of the element of the vector v, the original vector that we want. So v of I is then v prime, so the new one whose dimension is the original index minus the initial index of the first element in the original vector and plus 3. So that's very easy. So no search. That's the idea. So we don't waste time on finding where the element that we want is. So let's look at the example. In the previous example, B was 9, I was 6, and suppose we want I equal to 8. So where is this element in the new vector? So we said the index 8 minus the index of the first element, which is 6, and plus 3. So it's v prime of 5. So let's look at that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Exactly. So that's the one. So this position here corresponds to that position. So it's easy to find it in the new vector without almost any calculation. It's just one subtraction and one addition. So no search. That's very important. So we do not waste too much time to find the element that is necessary. Now, what may happen is that we go out of bounds. So, for example, if we provide illegal value for I here, it will go out of bounds here as well. So we do the mess, because this is implemented in C, C++. So this will not work. It will be chaos. And because of that, we need a boundary check, which is necessary computation. So is this index that is obtained inside of the boundaries? It will reduce a bit more the performance of random access. But if you want, in theory, to take risk and suppose that here the original index is always allowed, correct, then no problem. You don't need a boundary check. So if you can provide this guarantee externally, that's also possible. So we save space by this, because we have a lot of zeros or fail values in our matrices. Now, in SNORT, you have both DFA and NFA implementations, and you can choose which one to use at the installation time. DFA, as we have seen last time, to store that graph, consumes a lot of memory because the graph is complicated. It has a lot of connections, unlike the NFA graph that doesn't have a lot of connections. It's a tree. There are no circles there if we do not count the initial loop at zero state, but it's just one. So this will not take so much memory. Now, in DFA, if you use banded row format, you will not gain a lot. And why is that? Because this matrix gets less sparse. So it will not consume as many zeros as, for example, the NFA matrix. Because of that, so far, the default implementation of the Aho-Korosek algorithm has been NFA. However, in the recent times, it has happened that they are inclining towards DFA directly. And why is that? Because the computers have become more efficient, they contain more memory, and because of that, it is very often very easy to implement DFA directly. But this is changed all the time. Each new version has default either NFA or DFA, so you have to check what is the current policy of the company. But anyway, if you want really some of them, you can specify that at the installation time. Now, if you have an environment where a low memory consumption is important, then you use NFA. It's slower than DFA, but it doesn't use so much memory. If memory consumption is not critical, SNORT can be compiled in such a way that the DFA implementation is used, and in that case, banded row format is used for the next move function. As we said, it may happen that this matrix is not as sparse as the NFA matrix, but anyway, some saving is possible. Now, last time we said something about saving of the time if you use the DFA implementation, but we shall repeat that a bit later. In the default NFA implementation, NFA is not managed as we used that in the class. This was a kind of pedagogical implementation. Now, if you really want to implement it efficiently, then you can use some tricks. For example, NFA is managed as an array of linked lists, not the matrix, as usual. And then you can convert this array into a full or a sparse format NFA, depending on the number of transitions on an input symbol. If you have a lot of transitions, then you set a threshold, you see. So if this number is higher than a threshold given in advance, then you use NFA in full format, because then the matrix is not sparse. Because you see, the matrix for NFA is the row is the initial state where you are, and the column is the symbol that has arrived. And at the intersection, you have the next state. Yeah? Now, if you have a lot of next states, then this row will not be sparse. Even if the NFA is processed in the sparse format, the zero state transitions can be stored in the full format. Why? Because in zero state, you have always all transitions. It's not sparse because of the loop. So you see, they combine. So they have chosen the implementation that is most efficient in both ways, time and space. In the NFA implementation, the goto function and the failure function are merged. So you see, they don't keep them separated. And for each state, the state word is followed by the transition list for that state. This is very similar to the DFA, actually. So if you remember how DFA is made out of NFA, you take the state in which you are and all the possible outcomes, where you can go from that state. Now, then you make this function delta, and you have to memorize that. However, you can do it the other way, as they did it here. It's still NFA, but then you have the state word and the transition list for that state, all the possible transitions in each state. Now, what you do then, instead of one transition and the failure state, we have the start index of the transition state in this linked list. The NFA array is compacted into a single vector. You can always do that. So you just glue each row after another. So you, instead of n times m matrix, you have n times m length vector in that case. And then it's very easy. You have surely done that many times when you program things, how to compute the index in such a one-dimensional array if you get two dimensions for the matrix. That's very easy. So if you want to address the ith row and the jth column in such a vector that was formed from a matrix, then it will of course be I minus 1 times the number of columns plus j. That's very easy. The number of search patterns, the length of the search text, and the size of the CPU cache, they affect the performance of the detection model. We have already seen that when we talked about the factors that affect the efficiency of IDS. Performance of the DFA implementation, the NFA implementation in full and sparse format, they depend on the problem at hand, which means what we have obtained as the search string, which means either a single packet or a stream of packets, and what we are looking for, which means the patterns that we are looking for. So, which means it's not always guaranteed that DFA is better than NFA. And the problem is that when you compile, when you install Snort, you say, I want NFA or I want DFA. DFA. This will not always give you advantage. It would be nice if you could switch between DFA and NFA all the time, but that's not possible. Then you would have to reinstall Snort for each packet. That's crazy. So you never do that. Which means that for some packets, DFA will be better, and for some, NFA will be better. So you take some risk, and you can, by experience, see what is happening, and then you can switch between the implementation that would, with high probability, guarantee the best performance, but not the probability one, unfortunately. So that was about how time optimization and space optimization is performed in the implementation of the search algorithm, in most cases, AhoKoraSeq, in SNORT. Now we are going to say something about the rules. We have mentioned them many times. We have seen some examples. And now we are going to concentrate on the details and learn how to write these rules and how to read them. Of course, we learn how to read the rules first, and then we learn how to write new rules. These rules, these are text records that are obtained from attack signatures, and attack signatures are for known attacks obtained from the knowledge that we have about the attack. So we know, for example, this attack is directed towards the port 80, that's web server, etc., etc. From this we make the rule. It's an easy to understand description language. Everybody says that it is easy to understand. You will see when we talk about Zeek rules that they are not so easy to understand because you need this pattern matching to master. These rules are stored in text files, and they are grouped, these files are grouped according to types of attacks, according to protocols, according to services. For example, you have HTTP rules, according to services like web server rules, etc., etc. So there are several of these categories. The main structural components of the rules are the rule header and the rule option. The rule header contains the action that the rule triggers. So we have already seen that, alert or something like that. And then protocol used in the analyzed packet like TCP. And then source and the destination IP address and source and the destination ports. So that's all easy to understand. And then we have the rule option where we first have what to send to the operator if the rule triggers. So it's text. So it can be anything. And then the information about the parts of the packet that are to be analyzed in order to determine whether the rule triggers or not. Usually the content of the packet and something else, you will see. And here is, well, one of the recent attacks, WannaCry. Everybody has heard about that. So it's ransomware. So it's a kind of attack that enciphers or encrypts your disk and says, give me the money and I'll decrypt it. So that's the modern, one of the modern attacks, recent attacks that cause much harm. So there is a rule for that in SNORT. It doesn't sound very, let's say, easy to read, but you will see if you learn the structure, then you will easily learn this. So first of all, the action. So this here before the first parenthesis, sorry, this is called the rule header. So first, what to do if trigger? Alert the operator. So there are other actions. For example, if you use it as IPS, then you can say block, for example. Or drop, you will see what actions are. So usually, if it is intrusion detection system, then it's alert. What's the protocol? It's UDP. The UDP protocol. Now, home net is what you define as a home network. So the range of IP addresses that you monitor. What is the port? Any port. So this is where the traffic is coming from. So home net, any port. Now where it is addressed to is any host in our network, but port 53. You see, this is the intelligence, that's knowledge about this attack. Okay, so as we said, this is a misuse detection system, which means the attack has to be known from before. So it has happened before. Now, since we know where it leaves traces, we know what to search for in order to trigger next time if any such traffic appears. So the attack is addressed to the port 53. For some reason, the attacker chose that port. Now, if so, and if some other causes are, some other conditions are met, then this is the start of the rule option. So the message to the operator will be WannaCry. So that's this attack. Now, in addition to being UDP traffic coming from home net any port and being directed to any host in our network port 53, it also has to meet these conditions. The flow has to be to server. So they don't say established. So it's just traffic that is directed to some server that is at the port 53. Now the content in the packet, it must be this, you see, 29, ignore the vertical lines. The vertical lines are the, we have already said that. These are instructions to the snort interpreter that this 29 is a hexadecimal number. And then the other one says the rest is text. So ASCII or Unicode, so you have this, I, U, Q, I, R, etc., etc., very strange text. And then you say, you have another hexadecimal number, 03, and then QOM, and then 00. So if you find in your packet this string, you see, what is the length of this string? It's interesting, we could count, but I think it's smaller than 64. We could use some fast algorithms to find that. And we always think about how we could find these strings in an efficient way. Now, the rest is meta information. So it doesn't affect triggering. So reference where you can get information about this attack. VirusTotal.com, English, domain, and then this. You say information. So this is the web address. And then about class type Trojan activity, we are going to discuss that a bit later. So for now, leave it, but consider it as meta information. So it will not affect triggering. It's information about something else. We are going to see that. And then this snort ID of this rule is 44037, and the revision of this rule is 3, so the version of the rule. So they sooner or later change these rules if they learn some more details about some attack. So when will this trigger? It will trigger when we have UDP traffic coming from our own network to any from any port to our own network, some host at the port 53, where the flow of the traffic is to server. And the content found in the packets, it may be a set of packets. It may not be just one. So we say that UDP, it has no formal sessions because there is no establishment of connection in UDP. However, the sequence of packets between two ports and two hosts that is not broken by something else, it is considered a session in UDP as well. So if we in this session find somewhere this string, then, in addition to this, of course, then the rule will trigger, and it will say it's WannaCry attack. And then the operator has to react immediately and stop this traffic, because otherwise it will encrypt the hard disk of that attacked machine. And then you will have to first buy usually bitcoins, and then you have to pay these bitcoins. And there is no guarantee that the criminals will decipher your disk anyway. They take the money and run. So do your backup. So This is a summary. The rule header contains the action alert, the protocol UDP, the source IP address determined by the global variable home net. We are going to see in the exercise what this can be. So there is a file called snort.conf where this home net variable is defined. So what is our home net? Then the source port any, the destination IP address is any, the destination port is 53. So that's the rule header. And the rule option, the alert message, it's not so important because the alert message, as we said, can be any text. But now, of course, since we know that this is the signature of the WannaCry attack, it's logical to call it, well, alert, this is WannaCry. The alert message, and in addition, the conditions that are important to be satisfied in order for the rule to trigger, flow to server and the content, especially the content. The information about the attack, reference class type, and then the internal identifier of the rule. So we are going to discuss this class type a bit later. This is about priorities. So what are the basic actions? It may be alert, it may be pass, it may be log, if we are talking about intrusion detection. So you can either alert on match, you can ignore on match, that's pass, if you know that this is false alarm. And you can just log this information, you don't have to alert. So it depends on what you want when you write a rule. Now this is intrusion detection. If you are talking about intrusion prevention, there are additional actions like drop, which means block and log. Okay, so you will block this traffic, but log in some internal file on the system information about this match. Then reject. So in addition to block and log, you try to reset the sender. So send the reset signal to the sender if it is possible, because the sender may block this. Then you can decide what to do on match. You can activate a procedure, and that's called the dynamic rule. So that's called that's activated if you have the option activate, and also dynamic. So this is something similar. And then we have S-drop, which is blocking without logging. This is if we have limited memory on the sensor. We just block this traffic on match. So this activate and dynamic, this is used in relation with what we call dynamic rules. So we can actually create the rules on the fly. That's the idea. Not before the snort is started. This is very interesting. Now, of course, the extreme application of this is in other systems, like Zeek, you will see, so we can write procedures. And that's actually very interesting. Now, the protocols that Snort can analyze, it's a very limited number, TCP, UDP, ICMP, and IP. So the protocol field is just one of these four. So you cannot have in Snort 2.9, Snort 2 that we first study, you cannot have, for example, alert HTTP in the rules. But in Snort 3, you can do it. We are going to see that. Addresses and ports can be given as explicit numbers or variable names, which is like home net, external net, something like that. This operator, the arrow, is called the direction operator. So you either have this from left to right, or you have the bidirectional, but you don't have from right to left in Snort, in the old Snort, the Snort 2. There are four categories of rule options. The first one is general options that provide information about the rule but do not affect attack, like message, reference. So that's meta information. Then you have payload options that analyze payload data in order to detect patterns that trigger the rule. So that's content. URI content is actually, this is like obsolete, because now you have another policy with the creators of Snort. They actually introduced what is called modifiers. So you would usually have content and then HTTP URI instead of URI content, but you can still use this. So that's for compatibility with old rules. This activates search. Then you have non-payload options, which analyze non-payload data in the packet, like frag offset, TTL, etc., etc. They are some very specific elements, if we know that for some attacks. And then you have post-detection options that define actions to be performed upon triggering the rule, like log2 session, etc., etc. This is usually related to the IPS part. Now, most of these options have very many parameters that enable precise packet inspection. Now, we are, of course, not going into details of this. For those that are interested in details, read the manual. So they have very detailed manual that define each parameter for each rule option, etc., etc. So it's tens of pages. Now, how do we put our rule information into memory in order to use it efficiently? The rule header and the rule option since the very beginning of implementation of Snort, and this is actually described in the first paper about Snort back in 1999, something like that. So it's pretty old already system. But from the very beginning, they have been mapping the header and the rule options into special data structures, special linked lists that we are going to discuss now. And recently, there have been some modifications of this policy in order to be even more efficient. But the original implementation is like this. You have the rule header that is put in rule tree nodes and rule option in so-called option tree nodes. So RTNs and OTNs that we are going to discuss now. Now, at the time Snort loads and parses the rule set, they form all this. So once and then use it all the time. So the initialization you will see in the exercise after starting Snort may take some time before Snort is ready. It will write on the screen, commencing processing the packets. But for this, you will have to wait sometimes a couple of minutes. Because this rule, the number of these rules is pretty large, and you have to put all of them into such structures. So we are talking about three-dimensional linked lists that we are going to discuss now. So the rule header is mapped, as we said, into what is called rule tree node, or RTN, which are, these RTNs are changed into one dimension of the linked list. So you know what linked list is. In linked list, you have records that have two fields. One field is the content, and the next field is the pointer to the next element in the linked list. So everybody knows that. So it's a structure like that. The RTNs are changed as one dimension. Now, each protocol has its own linked list. So these linked lists are partitioned per protocol. So you have RTNs for TCP, RTNs for UDP, etc., etc. The second dimension is from the options, and that's called option tree node, or OTN. Now, several rule options can have the same rule header, so the corresponding OTNs for one same RTNs are chained under this RTN. So we have for each RTN, you have a whole linked list of the corresponding OTNs. We are going to give an example for this. The third dimension is a chain of function pointers, and each function pointer actually performs one check of one part of this rule, checking one option in the OTN, like content. So one function pointer can be to the search algorithm. And they actually realize the checks of the OTN options. This is a schematic on the slide 105, how this looks like. So you have RTN1, for example, where you have source IP address, destination IP address, source port, and destination port. Now, there are many rules that have the same thing. So, for example, home net any and destination IP address home net some port 80, for example, and these will all fall under RTN1. Then you have RTN2 with some other source IP address, destination IP address, source port, and destination port. For each of them, you have the options. For rule 1, you have what options are to be checked. And for these options, each of them has its own function pointer, pointer to that function. For example, search content, that's one. Or is the content to server, that's another option. Is the connection established, that's a third option, etc., etc. Every packet is first compared along the RTN linked list. So we find where we have the source IP, destination IP, source port, and destination port that correspond to this particular rule. So until we find a match with a particular RTN, if any. If not, then we just cannot analyze that traffic. In the case of a match, the packet is further checked along the options. So we have the OTN linked list of the matching RTN. So each option is checked by means of this functional pointer to this function that checks. Every OTN in the list must be checked until an eventual match is found. If not, then we just drop analyzing further, because for a rule to trigger, everything has to match, each element of the rule. How do we check these elements? We use these function pointers, and that's this third dimension list, this one. Option 1, option 2, etc., etc. Option 1 can be content, for example. During the third dimension list traversal, when an option from the OTN is found to match the analyzed packet, then the current option checking function calls the next. So that's a kind of chain, and that's why we said that it's a linked list as well. If any of the option checks fails, as we have said, a mismatch is found, then we dropped. So the packet is checked against the next OTN in the second dimension list. Now, how does it work? This is an example. So you see, we have two very similar rules. The first one, these are old attacks, but it doesn't matter. This is just an example. So we have alert TCP home net any to external net HTTP ports. And here, alert TCP home net any to external net HTTP ports. So the rule 3 node will be the same. So RTN will be the same because the header, the rule header is the same. So that means this part. Now, since these are two different rules, then they will have two different OTNs. So where is the difference? Of course, message doesn't count because that's free text. Now, what counts is this. You have here in the first rule, flow from client established, and here flow from client established, so that's the same, okay? And then content eml.eml, here content.emf, so there is a difference in one letter. So for this, and of course this is a modifier, so instead of this we could have uricontent, .html. So instead of this content.html HTTP URID, which is a modifier to the content, we could have a keyword uricontent.html and nothing on this. So that's the same rule. But this is the modern way. So the policy has changed on writing these rules. So now, nowadays, they make it like this. So there is a content, and then HTTP URI is the modifier. So there is a small difference, you see, between these two rules. Of course, this message is different because these are two different attacks. So the first one is Web Client Outlook EML Access, and here Web Client Microsoft EMF Meta File Access. Now, some old attacks. So these rules, as we said, they share the rule header. Because of that, they will share the RTN. In the internal store representation, the OTNs will be different, and the function pointers to the function that performs the option will be the same. Why the same? Because it's content. So that's the function. The function is search for here .tml and here for .tmf in the HTTP URI. So what is the difference, by the way? This has nothing to do with the discussion about RTNs and OTNs, but to explain HTTP URI. Now, it informs Snort about where to search for EML. So if we don't say HTTP URI, it will search in the whole packet, the header and the content. And if we say HTTP URI, it will search only in the header. That's more efficient because header is shorter. Okay, let's have a break. Okay, apparently there is no noise.
Yeah, that's great.
They listen to my appeals. Okay, we can continue. So we have started analyzing how these two rules that are very similar will be handled inside Snort. So we have seen that there is just one small difference. Here you have .eml to search for, and here you have .emf to search for, ignoring, of course, the message. The message is free text. So everything else is the same. So we said that, okay, we have to do some content search in the HTTP URI, which means we have to activate the same procedure in both rules. So that's the option content. It will be checked by the Ahokoresic algorithm, and the function pointers called from both OTNs will point to the same function implementing that algorithm. For example, if you look at the scheme, you see the option one for the first rule will be, for example, search for this .eml. So to perform this search, it will call the search procedure here. Now, if it is found .eml, then it will eventually, if there are more options, it will call another option from this. If not, then it will go and check the other option anyway. Now, if some option doesn't find what we need, then we actually stop searching further because the rule will not trigger. But this has nothing to do with this example. In this example, you have the first rule with option one search, and the second rule with option one search. Now, they both call the same function. So the pointer will be the same. The same function, Ahokoresic. And that's the concrete example. So they have the same RTN, these two rules, because they have the same parameters, home net, external net, any HTTP ports. So if you look at the rules, you see that home net, any external net, HTTP ports. So that's the same. So they will have the same RTN. And then OTN for rule one, it will be checking if it is flow from client established, and for the rule two, it will be flow from client established, the same. So it's the same function. Okay? And then if it is flow from client established, then we go to the next check. Content.emf for the rule two and content.eml in the URI for the first rule. So it will be the next function pointer in the list of function pointers. But the procedure that it calls will be again the same. So the first check was whether it is flow from client and the connection was established. So we can consider that a single check. So this is the same function. The same function, so the same function pointer points to the same function. And if this is satisfied, so it is flow from client established, then we check the next option, which is whether this .eml is found in the HTTP URI. Here the same. If this is satisfied, then we check whether the .emf is found in the HTTP URI. Now, if both are satisfied, then we trigger the rule. So this is how it works. So the internal implementation of rules is in the form of RTNs, OTNs, and these functional pointers. And we have seen on an example of two very similar rules how this actually works. So you can imagine, since we have many rules, there will be a lot of RTNs here in this linked list, and for each RTN, it will be a lot of these OTNs in each linked list. The number of function pointers will be limited because there are like 20, 30 checks. How do we classify the snort rules? We have what we call no-content rules, which do not require that we check the payload. These are easy and cheap to check, whether they trigger or not. Then the payload detection rules or content rules, they require activation of the search algorithm. So this is expensive and slow. If we can detect some attack without activating the content check, that would be nice. Unfortunately, that's not very often today. And then unicontent rules that are, as we said, similar to content rules, they are faster to analyze because usually the URI is shorter than the whole packet session. Only because of that. You see, the time complexity of once we make the go-to function, failure function, and the output function of the, or the pattern matching machine, how it is called, in the Yahoo-Korosek algorithm, that takes some time. But after that, the time complexity of check, of matching, is linear in the length of the search string. Now, the search string is shorter for URI than for the whole session. That's why it is better to detect attacks with URI content, if possible. So if what we are searching for is in the URI, such rules are checked faster than the content rules. Although they are the same, they activate the search algorithm. Each of these rule groups characterizes the corresponding group of attacks. For example, some attacks can be detected by inspecting the packet headers only. They are easy to detect. For detection of some attacks, we have to inspect the packet payload, which is slow. And if we can avoid that, as we said, we do that. And some attacks may be detected by inspecting the implementation of specific protocol elements, in this case, the URI. Now, we have some ready-made rules present in snort upon installation. We can also create custom rules that are specific for our monitor network. We are going to back to that a bit later when we talk about post-installation adjustments of snort. And why do we do that? Because we want to reduce the number of false positives, and we have to reduce the number of false negatives, which is obtained by avoiding dropping packets. In some cases, it is possible to detect an attack by inspecting the packet header only, which is nice if we can do it. So some attacks are easy to detect. For example, it was relatively difficult for me to find an example for this. And why? Because there are not so many attacks that are as easy to and cheap to detect as this one. But this is an example. Protocol SCADA DMP3, this is SCADA protocol, maybe you have. So DMP3, corrupt configuration. So detecting such an attack is an example of no content detection, since only the packet header is inspected. And here is the rule. So the corresponding snort rule: alert TCP, external net from the port 20,000 to home net, any port. Message, protocol, SCADA, or whatever, this is free text. And then flow established to client, you see, so it's from server to client. So sometimes it's that way. Now, DMP3 int config corrupt. So you see, there are some elements of this DMP3 protocol. Metadata, policy, max detect, IPS, drop, etc., etc. So this is meta information. So just ignore that. snort identifier and version 6 of this rule. Now, what's this? Alert defines an action to be performed upon finding the match between the incoming traffic and the rule. So we know that. So that's this one. TCP is the protocol used in the traffic. Then we have external net, indicates where the traffic comes from. 20,000, the source port that is used. Okay? Then we have home net, destination, indicates where the traffic is directed. So some host in our home net, maybe many hosts, but in our net. Okay? Any indicates any destination port. But that's easy. Now, this, the rest is this TMP3 protocol specific, what has to match. So let's see what it is. If the match is found, then the message protocol SCADA DMP3 corrupt configuration is displayed. So that's free text, as we said. Now, this one, DMP3 IND, is a flag that is used in the TMP3 protocol header. So what will be the value of this? It will be config corrupt. So you find this. So you analyze the flags in this DMP3 packet, and you find that DMP3 IND, is its value is config corrupt. So you don't search for anything. You just get check the header, because the flag is in the header. The keyword flow is used to explain the TCP stream reassembly behavior that is relevant for do. So it's two client. So in English text, how would we interpret this rule? Generate an alert on TCP traffic that originates outside of the monitor network from the port 20,000 and is directed to clients any port after the connection is established and has the flag DMP3 IND set to config corrupt. And of course it is, I forgot this, I should actually have written this as well. It is directed to the client. Okay, so you can translate this rule into English, and from this you see that we do not search for anything. We just check the flag, which is in the header of this DMP3 protocol. So that would be easy if we could detect attacks this way. However, unfortunately, very often, in most cases, we have to activate these search algorithms. And this will be found in many rules. This content, URI content, content, HTTP URI, etc., etc. That's all activating the Aho Korosik or any other algorithm if they are implemented for search. For example, NetBIOS SMB CD dot dot. We have already seen this rule where we illustrated something different. But what is important in this example is that it has the content field. The content field activates this. Search for this. 5C, that's hexadecimal. Then text, Unicode, for example, dot dot slash. Then three hexadecimal numbers again. So this is the content rule, because it has search involved. The same, alert is the action, TCP the protocol, external net any port, home net port 139, that's not NetBIOS, this service. The value of the flow keyword indicates that the rule triggers on the traffic directed to the server after the connection is established, and then we have the content, which is typical for suspicious payload detection rules. So it will search for the string in the packet payload, and if the match is found and all the rest matches, then we get NetBIOS SMB CD dot dot message displayed on operator's console. And in English, of course, generate an alert on TCP traffic containing the string 5C dot dot slash 000000 in the payload directed from the outside of the monitor network to the port 139 of the monitor network, where the rule triggers a traffic directed to the server after the connection is established. So that's how we should read this rule in English. Now, what is this attack? So this specific attack is an attempt to circumvent the directory access control by executing remotely the command cd dot dot. So we have cd dot dot slash, and then we do whatever. So if there is such vulnerability, so we, in modern operating system, this is prevented. The string that Snort searches is actually a system command. So if we find this system command in the traffic, that means that's the attack. The flow keyword is used in the rule in order to reduce the number of false positives, since the attack can only be present in the traffic towards the server. So these are still content rules, and we say any rule that inspects packet payloads requires search for string given by the content keyword or keywords, there may be more than one in each packet, which is much slower than just header inspection. Because in header we have predefined header elements and we only check them. So it can be a kind of very, very because if the number of values that are necessary to put in these headers, if it is not too high, too large, then we can use tricks to check this. We don't need search. We can use an array, something like that. Because of the, for example, a typical example is the version of IP. So it's either version 4 or version 6. So we can use 0.1 or something like that. So it's very easy to check if we don't have too many values. So if we can avoid the packet payload inspection, we should avoid that. However, it's not very often the case that we can avoid that. And this is slow. Finally, we have uricontent rules, which are content rules, but the search string is taken from a different position. So it's just the header of the packet. The semicolon bug, that's very old attack, 20 years old. So it was on, I don't know, Microsoft web server from 2000, something like that, 20 years ago. So there was a bug. And this bug was exploited by this attack. So the rule to detect this attack would be alert TCP external net any to home net HTTP ports. So you see, the variable, it's not just port 80. When we open snort.conf tomorrow, you will see that the list of HTTP ports is like 4 or 5 rows in these files, a lot of ports. And we shall discuss how we detect that it is HTTP. That also deserves some discussion, especially when we talk about Zeek. Now, the message to the operator, if the rule triggers, is web internet information server multiple extension code execution attempt. So that's official warning. Now, flow to server established or established to server, it doesn't matter the order. Now, this is important. So the content is .asp and then hexadecimal 3b and then dot. No case, which means it can be capital letter, ASP, doesn't matter. Now, this is the modifier, HTTP URI. So this means that we search for this string only in the header, not in the content, not in the payload. This is more efficient than if we don't put this modifier. We could use content ASP3B dot as well. But that check would be slower because it would check in the entire packet, not only in the header. It's not necessary to check in the content because it's not there. We know in advance. So the action is alert, the protocol is TCP, the traffic may originate from any network, but it is directed towards HTTP ports, usually port 80, but it can be like 100 ports. If the match in the content field, .asp3b hexadecimal dot, regardless of the case is found, then the message web, internet information server, etc., etc., is displayed on the console and an alert is raised. The HTTP URI keyword is the modifier to the content keyword, and it instructs the Snort system to search only in the header. That's the same as the URI content keyword that was used before. You can still use it, but it's obsolete. Now, what is the semicolon bug? It is a known vulnerability of earlier versions of Microsoft Internet Information Server, IIS, possibility for IIS to execute any extension as an active server page or any other executable extension, so-called semicolon bug. For example, this, malicious.asp, and you mask it as a picture. So the system thinks that it's a figure, something, but it's actually a malicious procedure, script or something. So these ASP, these are scripts. So it is executed as an ASP file on the server, even though the server thinks that it is an image. So by using this vulnerability, an attacker can bypass the extension protection on IIS, so it will not allow .asp to execute, but it will allow .jpg to pass. So that's the idea of the attacker. Of course, it doesn't hold any longer. So the modern versions of Microsoft do not allow that. So it was a vulnerability. That's why it is very important for an attacker to know which version of software you use. If you use unpatched old version of something, you will be actually surprised how many pieces of old software unpatched is used in very critical system. If you go to the airport, you will find somewhere Windows XP or something that is not supported already for 8 years. So the English interpretation of the rule, any network traffic coming from the external network, which is intended for the HTTP ports of the monitor network, whose URI contains .asp3b hexadecimal dot, regardless of the case, generates an alert. This is testing URI content, because we have the URI, HTTP URI modifier. As we said, it's more efficient to use URI content or content with the modifier HTTP URI because we only perform search in a shorter search string, which is the header. So these were three types of rules. Roughly said, one doesn't require any content search at all, one requires full content search in the whole session, and one requires content search but only in the header. Now, we can write custom rules. In a real intrusion detection environment, intrusion coverage better than the one obtained with the generic rule set is needed. Why? Because otherwise you will have a lot of false positives and you may have false negatives, which is very bad. So how do we solve this? We increase granularity of the rules. We can define more specific rules. And we can do it in Snort by writing in a normal editor specific rules, so-called custom rules. Usually we start with an existing rule, but we can write from scratch as well. If we know a specific attack signature, then we can, starting from that signature, create a rule and include it in the set of rules processed by Snort. Of course, we know, we have seen that they are easily readable, rule syntax is not very complicated. Now, the drawback of the clarity of the syntax and the readability of the rules is reduced efficiency, since text files have to be processed, and text file processing is slower than binary file processing. We know that because we have carriage return, line feed, and other things that are not used in binary files. So, here is an example of a custom rule. We would like to alert on traffic from a particular URL. We know that this IP address is very dangerous. It's bad guy with this address, 194.147.191.33. So this was my IP address 20 years ago when we used modems and, yeah. So this was my IP address. So I'm a very dangerous guy. So we launch attacks. Now, how do we detect that traffic is coming from my IP address? We say alert TCP, this particular address, so no home net, not any. We can put this, the address. Any port to home net, for example, HTTP ports, message suspicious HTTP traffic. So if I try to access some web server that is protected by this rule, it will say, no, no, that's the dangerous guy, don't do it. Don't send 200 OK. Say 403, forbidden. Okay? So, alert is the action. TCP is the protocol. We monitor traffic from any port from this address. So, it's very easy to interpret. In the case of a match, we alert an operator with this suspicious HTTP traffic. So this is very, very imprecise rule, very general. Okay? Because of that, since there are no more elements in the rule, since we want alert to be raised on any traffic coming from that address, I say this is very dangerous IP, so don't accept anything from that. Now, this can serve as a starting point for rule definitions if we want more refined definition. For example, we can add that it's not from any port, that it is from port 80, or that it is the traffic must match something. We add content Slobodan, for example, or attack, or something like that, and then it will not match on just anything from that address. It will match if it also meets other requirements. Now, last time when we talked about search algorithms, we said that we shall demonstrate how search works in Snort. And here is how we show that. So we are going to process a packet in the Snort detection module. We analyze packet against a single rule. The packet has been previously processed in the pre-processing stage, and the decision model is run with the NFA implementation of the Yahoo Corosec, which is the default. And here is the rule. So how do we execute this? This is the rule: alert TCP external net HTTP ports to home net any port. The message: web client Microsoft ANI file parsing overflow. Flow from server established. You see, from server. Content: there must be ref with capital letters, or content and or. Actually, it's and. Content ref and content anich. And no case means that it can be mixture of capital and small letters. It can be small letters, it can be capital letters. Doesn't matter. Class type, we said this is about priorities. For now, we only say that. It's attempted user. So this attack exploits a group of vulnerabilities of the Microsoft Windows operating system related to misuse of .ref, resource interchange file format, and .ani, animated cursor files. This is also very, very old. If such files are found attached to email messages or embedded in HTML code or scripts, it may produce buffer overflow in some old versions of Windows, and then open the door for taking over machines running Windows. So it has been demonstrated that it works, but that was for example, Windows 2000, something very old. The content fields of the rule are relevant for the search performed by the detection module. In this case, we have two content fields, which means that the pattern set is ref and anich. We have the no case modifier. No case will instruct Snort to modify this set of patterns. It will convert to capital letters, everything. Because actually, no case means the case doesn't matter. And the whole input string will be converted to uppercase before processing by the Yahoo CoreSeq algorithm, because otherwise it will not be detected. Now, this is the input to the Yahoo CoreSeq algorithm. Now, what is the go-to transition function? It's very easy. There are no overlap between ref and annex, so it will be two separate paths. And we are waiting for either R or A in the state zero. So this will be the go-to transition function for this. The failure transition function, if you remember last exercise, we actually gave this example and said, do it for homework. Now, if you did it for homework, you would actually get the failure transition function that is very easy. And this is usually very easy if we don't have overlaps between these paths, so everything goes to zero. So if you are, for example, here at the state 2, waiting for an F, and A has arrived. See what happens. It says go to 0, try to match an A. And you may actually terminate in the state 5 still, but it will not tell you to go directly to the state 5 if you are here, because there is just one possibility of getting to the state 5. So we discussed that last time, if you remember. And the output function is also very easy at the state 4 ref and the state 8 anich. If an email with the attachment anifile.c, anifile.c were opened, then there may be something in that file as well beside this. But it contains the string, because this was actually in the attack string. Ref header ID is equal to akon anich. Now, before that, we may have something. After that, we may have something. And we are looking for ref and anich. So we have to find both. That's why we have two content fields in our rule. And we said between them, it's and. It's not or. It's not ref or anich found. Then it's not this attack. It may be something with only ref or something with only anich, but this is with both. Because the attack contains all this. We suppose that the packet contains only this string, although it can be more. But it will not affect our search, because before this first R, you would wait in the state 0 all the time, waiting for either R or A. So in our email, we have this. Ref header ID equal to akon anich, so we start moving from the state 0. So R, I, F, F, we have found this first, then we go to 0. Then we find A, but then immediately go to 0, etc., etc., R, and then failure, etc., etc., akon, A also, then failure, and finally, with this A, we find anich. This is what is happening. So if you look at the go-to graph and failure function, output function, so you first wait in the state 0 for R. Now, R has arrived, so you go to 1, 2, 3, 4, you have found ref. You produced output. And then you have, if you remember, you have a space. Space will move you to 0 state. Then you are still waiting for either R or A, but H has arrived, so you stay at 0. E has arrived, stay at 0. A has arrived, go to 5 here. But then D has arrived. The failure function says go to 0, try to match D, no, so you remain at 0. Then E, the same thing, wait in 0. Then R has arrived, move to 1, but then failure. I has arrived. No, I is still, I is still legal because we are looking for R, I, F, F. So I says go to 2, but then you have failure, D. So go to 0 because the failure function says so, and then try to match D in 0, no, so you remain at 0. Then equal sign, remain at 0. Then the apostrophe, remain 0. Then A arrived, so go to 5, but then failure. C has arrived, then 0, 0, apostrophe 0, 0, but then you have anich. So you have found both, reef and anich, and it will give you a positive match of this rule. So that was about rules. The next discussion in our discussion on snort is how do we log an alert? So we can alert by means of this messaging, we have seen that. But we can define in many ways how we alert. So the task of the logging and alerting is to deliver alerts to the operator in the most efficient way without jeopardizing overall throughput of the IDS. It has to be fast. So we have versatile, pluggable modules compatible with other presentation technologies, which is very important because usually, and we are going to see that next week, we do it with a database. And we can also outsource the resource-intensive tasks to other applications, which is also done in Snort. So you will find there are two applications. One is called Barnyard. Interestingly enough, this is like a joke from the author. So everything that they produce is somehow related to pigs. So it's Snort is and the nose, then Barnyard is for small pigs, and then you have, well, very, very strange. And then we have Base, a special subsystem that relates these alerts from this special format that we are going to see with the database. So it is possible to integrate Snort in the existing logging and alerting schemes on the operating system level. We are going to see that, something like Swatch and things like that. Now, we are going to discuss what is called event correlation. So usually, attack is not just one source of information. There may be several. And we have to correlate them. So we may detect one suspicious thing, but this may be a part of a bigger picture. And we want to relate all these, and we can do it with Snort. And that's called event correlation. For example, we can have a port scan, which is not by itself dangerous, but it may announce other attacks, or it may mean that it is already in progress, which is even worse. So we have to search for other things related to this. So we have to somehow correlate the port scan with other suspicious activities in our network. We can do it by means of an IDS, but these may be detected other attacks by other devices like firewall, antivirus, whatever. So attack can be something very complex. So this process of gathering data from various sources for the purpose of intrusion detection and discovering relations between them, it's called event correlation. And that's very important in system-wide intrusion detection. Because today's systems that deserve installation of intrusion detection, they are large, complex, and the attack against, for example, I don't know, an airport reservation system, it must not be directed only to some single host. Maybe directed towards many elements of this system. By correlating events from several devices, we can obtain a global picture of security of the monitored network. The problem is the size of the packet payload data to be collected. So it may be terabytes of data. Now, we can log, of course, all the payloads when possible if we have enough memory, means hard disk, SSD, whatever. And this is a lot, of course. And we can set limits. So we can set like 120 megabytes and that's it. Now, why do we do that? Because historical data matter. So the operator can analyze them offline. And one of the possibilities why we do that would be to check whether this suspicious data is launched by a human or by an automatic piece of software, some robot. Because if you have a lot of data, it's probably not a human. It's probably some net web crawler or something like that. This is called, no? Searching for vulnerabilities. So they scan actually the whole internet and search for vulnerable hosts. Organizations do that. Script kiddies do that. Everybody can do that. If you have enough time and resources, you can do that. You know, reserve one machine to scan vulnerabilities everywhere. And then it will warn you, there is a suspicious host. Now, you can do it for benevolent purposes, which is good. Then you warn the victim, potential victim, you have a vulnerability. But if you are an attacker, you attack, or you make an exploit. So such things do not target any host in particular. They want to find a vulnerable machine because they have found that this version of operating system or some software has this vulnerability. I want to find which machine on the internet or in some organization is vulnerable to this, and then I make an exploit as an attacker. Now, if we are the defensive side, we are defending from attackers, for us, the worst thing is not this crawler looking for vulnerabilities. For us, we want to know whether we are really the target of an attack. So not by chance, but by purpose. Now, if so, then we are not dealing with one script kiddie. We are probably dealing with some organization or state. Has happened many times, is happening and will happen. So that's already warfare. If the conclusion of the IDS is that the attack is performed by a human, it is possible from the collected intrusion data to determine skill level. So is it a kid or is it a criminal? Criminals usually do not possess too much knowledge about these things. They exploit others' knowledge. Okay, they may buy. Of course, mafia, you know, from the movies. I have never met any mafia, but from the movies they have consigliere. Consigliere is very clever. He usually knows everything. He's educated. So this is possible. But in reality, not very often. However, if we are talking about large organizations like military, state, etc., they possess knowledge, they possess resources, and that's very dangerous. And we can determine, by analyzing the data, what they are using, what tools they are using, how much they know. Okay, let's have a break. Okay, we can continue. So we discussed this event correlation. Now, you will see later something more about this event correlation, because this can be achieved not only with IDS, it can be achieved with other tools. Now, first of all, we are going to talk about how to output from Snort. So there are many possibilities, not only text on the console. And text on the console is not the best way to forward the information to other subsystems, like database, etc. Okay, hopefully this will not start to make noise again. Okay, so Snort sends information to the operator of the output device through output plugins. So you have plugins and you activate the plugins in configuration files. In snort.conf you activate where to put the output. Default is console. And this will improve the efficiency of the whole system by making alerting more efficient. The output plugins that are used are the means that Snort has to get intrusion data from the detection engine to the operator or end the output device. Actually, Snort has plugins for everything, not just for alerting. So you can switch off, switch on. We have already seen you can switch off the preprocessors. You can redirect the output from one thing to another, etc., etc. This is something that allows efficient reconfiguration and fine-tuning of Snort. You can easily change the parameters of the plugins or switch them off if necessary. Now, what are these formats? It can be TCP dump, raw data, and you can have many other formats like CSV, that's very useful text format for reading directly from the database. You choose the output format according to the operator's preferences or skill level. Not everybody can read database. Or configuration of the monitor network, how you have your network configured. In general, the outputs from Snort are not human readable unless it's a text file. Now, text file is slow. Of course, outputting to a text file is also possible if we play in the class like we do. But if you really want to use Snort seriously, you don't do that. The default output is the raw binary TCP dump format. Now, what else is available? Syslog, that's standard for operating system. So you can put your data in the operating system logs by means of this output. Then you may have TCP dump, that's raw data, Unified 2. Before, in the earlier versions, it was called Unify, now it's called Unify 2. That's the most efficient format. Then, if you have pure Unix, you have this Unix SOC, you have database format CSV, you have no output. If you don't want output, you can say null. In addition, we may have ordinary text output on the console or in a text file. You can choose alert fast or alert full, which is a lot of data, so this will be slow. For each output format, we have separate output plugin, and the default or actual output plugin is put here, snort.conf. You will see tomorrow we are going to work with Snort. In practice, we shall see snort.conf and many other things. And we learn how to install it, how to use it, how to detect, for example, port scans, which is not done by rules. Now, how do we present the data to the user? It is not done in Snort. It is left to the applications. What Snort does is writing somewhere the most efficient way possible. And of all these modes that are possible, writing data in relational database, it was very, very carefully studied by the designers, and the relation between Snort and the database is paid attention to by means of the applications that we have already mentioned, Barnyard and Base. Now, why is that? Because database is very nice for presentations. So you can choose your own query, how you want to list the data, etc., etc. You can use graphics, you can use many things. So this is nice. And since this is separated from Snort, Snort can run fast without presenting and wasting too much resources for graphics and lists and histograms and whatever. Now let's review some of these outputs. So the format syslog is the standard for operating system. For example, logging. Log files, if you open any log file, you will see that it uses this syslog file. Now, if many applications use syslog file, you can aggregate all the information in one file, which is nice. So you can combine, that's why we talked about event correlation. You can combine information that you get from routers, from firewalls, from other IDS, from many other things, from the operating system into a single log. And then you can use some application to analyze this log automatically. This is nice if we want host-based intrusion detection. Then we have raw TCP dump format. Now, TCP dump is a tool that can read it and present it in human readable form. That's very old, like 30 years old, but it is still used. Because of that, logging in TCP dump is very useful capability of Snort, but the size of the data is limited to this by default. You can change that, so it's not much data. But remember, that was designed 30 years ago. Then we didn't have so much data in our computers. This one is Snort specific, Unified 2, and it's most important because this is the connection between Snort and the databases. So in the first versions of Snort, like 1998, 1999, the problem that the designers experienced was that the output formatting significantly reduced the overall efficiency of the IDS. It became slow just because of the outputting. And you have, as programmers, usually noticed that if you have a lot of printing in your program, it gets slow. Okay, so that's the same thing. Now, how to solve this in order to not to reduce bandwidth that Snort could process, especially with the complicated output formats? Then they actually decided to outsource interfacing with presentation tools to a new application that I have already mentioned. It's Barnyard 2. Of course, in the beginning, they had Unified and Barnyard. Now they have Unified 2 and Barnyard 2 that reads this Unified 2 format. So Unified 2 is a format that only Snort can read, but this is really efficient. It is a format that was specifically designed for that purpose, only to communicate with Barnyard 2. It's a custom binary format that was invented by the designers of Snort to make Snort logging as fast as possible. If we decide to use Barnyard 2, then the Snort will write the output data in the Unified 2 format to the disk at the maximum speed possible. And then after writing, it flushes its memory, continue analyzing the traffic, forgetting about what it has done before. And then the Barnyard 2 takes the control of the data and reads from that. It's like the kind of SOC what you have in Unix, but this is specific for Snort. Why do we do this? Because that frees up the Snort resources for processing more data. It will forget about the presentation. Barnyard 2 is the application that reads unified two formats and then parses them and converts them into various output formats, whichever, but usually various relational database compatible formats. And then you use a database like MySQL that we are going to use, for example, in our exercise, and you present them in a nice way by means of histograms and whatever. What they have achieved with this was speeding up Snort by 40%, which is significant, compared to outputting in, for example, text or whatever. Now, Barnyard 2 is totally independent of Snort, runs as a separate process. If we have threads, well, we can have this on modern machines, then they don't interfere each other. Alerts are usually posted to a database without affecting the ability of Snort to capture and analyze traffic. So it continues capturing and analyzing traffic independently. The next format is Unix SOC, which is the output plugin sets up a Unix domain socket and sends alerts to it. And then some external programs can listen on such a socket, receive Snort alerts in real time, and process them independently again of Snort. CSV, you can communicate with the database directly, but this is a text file. So this is not as fast as Unified 2. So CSV is the comma-separated value format that serves as a convenient input form for database. You have surely met that somewhere. And then CSV is read by all databases that we know. So Snort can directly create a CSV file, and then it can be read without Barnyard. That's the idea. But this is slower than writing to in the Unified 2 format and reading in by Barnyard. Null, it is sometimes useful for Snort to produce an alert without creating packet log entries. For this, we have this null output plugin. So we still produce alerts, send them to console, but we do not log. So if we don't have enough memory or something like that. So that was how to output, okay, from Snort. So how to write in files, display on console, etc. So what to do with this output is done by this displaying alerts. For this, we may have tool like this, Basic Analysis and Security Engine, BASE. That's typical. You will see in the exercise, not tomorrow, but next week, when we do this, that some of these tools, you know, open source is such that if you don't have people available to continue doing this, they just stop. Yeah. So that's the problem with this. So they have stopped developing this space, I would say, many years ago, but it's still working if we pick the right version of software. That's why you can download all that from Blackboard. I keep the versions that work. So what is BASE? BASE is a web front end to query and analyze Snort alerts. So it actually reads from a database and then presents in the form of usually some histograms, you will see. It is based on an earlier project analysis console for intrusion detection, ACID, which was popular like 15 years ago, maybe even before that. So ACID is not developed any longer. BASE is not developed any longer, but you can still use it. So that's acceptable. So what does BASE do? It reads intrusion data stored in a database and presents the data in a web browser. So you have Snort that outputs its alerts in Unified 2 format. Then you have Barnyard 2 that reads this Unified 2 format and outputs that to like CSV, puts in a database. And then you have BASE that reads from the database according to the query that the user makes and presents it in a nice form. So you have three things. You have Snort generating the alerts, you have Barnyard reading the alerts and converting them to database data, then you have database, and you have fourth element that is displaying data from the database. So Base can monitor events generated by other monitoring tools as well, such as firewalls, you can combine that. It has Query Builder, you can define your own query, and you have a search interface for finding alerts matching criteria defined in advance, like when the attack took place, what was the source destination IP address ports, what were the payload elements, what were the flags, etc., etc. So very flexible. You can also list the content of the packets to analyze manually. So you have built-in packet viewer and decoder. But of course, this is ancient. It's much better to analyze these packets if you want by means of this Wireshark. We have seen that in our first exercise. You can perform what is called alert management. So if you remember the general scheme of an IDS, you have a logging and alerting where you have alert filter. That filters the alert by priority. Okay? Why that? Because we don't want many false positives. And for this, we want to filter out the less priority, smaller priority data, lower priority data. Base can also communicate alerts by means of email. You can archive alerts. You can exchange them between alert databases. You can do many things with this base. And it has some powerful, well, relatively powerful graphical capabilities. You can use histograms there. You will see that in the exercise. And colors and all this is very nice. It can also generate statistics based on time, based on sensor, based on signature, protocol, IP address, TCP or UDP ports, whatever. Now, for event correlation, you could use IDS, but it's not the best tool for event correlation. For that, there is a specialized tool, and it is called Security Information Event Managers, or SIEM. And they have become popular because they can do this event correlation on the system-wide basis. In these systems, the alerts that are generated from an IDS, they are presented in a human-readable form. So instead of having Snort, Base, and all that, you can use this SIEM. So it can be a means of displaying IDS alerts as well, but they can do many more things. So the purpose of a SIEM is event correlation. And one, this is actually a French system, Prelude. It's popular and widely deployed example of a SIEM, which actually uses Snort as a source of data. Also Suricata recently, because at the time Prelude was first made, it was Suricata did not exist. So if you remember our discussion about rules and our examples with rules, we said this field we are not going to discuss now. We leave it for the discussion of prioritizing alerts, which we are going to do now. We would like to prioritize alerts because not all the attacks are equally dangerous. So something that requires urgent action has high priority. For example, these two situations. In one of them, we detect port scanning, which is not dangerous by itself. It may be an indicator of a possible attack in the future, but it doesn't have to be so. Of course, in both cases, whether it is an indicator of a future attack or not, it does not require immediate action by the operator. Now, that was one situation. In another situation, an attack that might immediately stop the operation of the monitor web server was detected, so you have to immediately react. So that attack would have a higher priority than this. That's the idea. That's why we have this class type. If you remember this field in the rules, is class type. That's something that has to do with prioritizing alerts. It's not only Snort that has this. Many IDS can do that, but not all of them use the same, have the same flexibility and granularity. We have seen that everything in Snort is modular and pluggable, which is very nice. The best option is to offer customizable prioritization, not fixed one, because you may have different requirements for your organization than somebody else with the same system. So users of the IDS define alert priorities. But of course, there is always a default configuration. The user doesn't have to define that each time. In modern networks, we need customizable prioritization because such networks are unique. So this network for this NTNU, for example, is quite different from even other academic networks. So everything is unique. Or especially if you compare it with some other kind of network like banking or, I don't know, railroad or whatever. Services that run are different. Traffic distributions are different and many other things are different. The only common characteristic is the protocol that they use, TCP/IP protocol stack, but even that is not always used. There are not non-IP networks that are used in, for example, SCADA especially there. By the way, what we are talking about on the theoretical level of intrusion detection doesn't apply only to TCP/IP. It applies to anything. So search algorithms, you will see machine learning techniques, all that can be applied anywhere, not just in TCP/IP network, which gets more and more usage nowadays because today's infrastructure is different than it was 20 years ago. So there are new modern protocols that are not based on this TCP/IP. TCP/IP is slow, it's stupid in the sense of when it comes to errors. Because if error in communication happens, then the whole information is repeated, which is very inefficient. So they don't use error-correcting codes, et cetera, which many other systems do. Like mobile telephony, they do that. So you, that's why in mobile telephony, you very often use UDP, not TCP, because the error correction is done in another system. So, well, we have in Snort high, medium, low, and very low priority. But you can also define your own level of priority. Now, these severity levels are closely related to the class type identifier of every rule. And this identifier categorizes attacks into classes of similar attacks. Now, what are the high priority event class types in Snort? For example, attempted administrator privilege gain. So somebody has tried to get administrator privileges, that should be pretty high priority. But it is not said that they succeeded. So the attempt doesn't mean success. Also, attempted user privilege gain or inappropriate content detected, whatever. You define what is inappropriate. Then potential corporate privacy violation. Well, you define how dangerous it is, whether this is punishable at all. Now, executable code detected, this may mean many things. Doesn't mean that it is dangerous always. Now, this is the worst thing, successful administrative privilege gain. It's much worse than attempted administrative privilege gain. So it's also one of the high priority event classes. Then successful user privilege gain, then a network trojan detected, unsuccessful user privilege gain, maybe you succeed next time. That's why it deserves high priority processing. Web application attack, it is by default high priority. So these are by default high priority in Snort. You can take out some of them if you like. Why would we take out some of them? Because successful administrative privilege gain is obviously more dangerous than attempted administrative privilege gain, for example. So you would not like this one to raise alarm every time, because this may be dangerous because somebody is, for example, trying password. So this time they fail, but next time they may succeed. But here, that means that they have succeeded, so they have control over your system. That's much more dangerous. So this would, for me, for example, personally be number one. The severity level of each of these categories can be modified arbitrarily. So that's if we want to take out some of these. And we'll give some examples. The operator can also add as many custom alert categories as necessary. So not only these priorities, high, low, etc., etc. And for this, we have a separate rule set just for priorities. Now, on an example, we illustrate all that. There is a file, classification.config, which is included in snort.conf by default. You have this. Config classification attempted admin, attempted administrative privilege gain, priority 1. Now we can edit this and say priority 2, for example. Now, this is the rule. Okay, so attempted admin is the name. It means attempted administrative privilege gain and has priority 1. Which means these attacks are considered the most dangerous for the monitored network. The administrative privilege gain, of course, if successful, guarantees the attacker full control, but it doesn't mean that it was successful. So any rule classified as attempted administrative privilege gain activity detection rule would correspond to the classification rule. So this is done in class type identifier. So class type will be attempted admin in the rule. And here is an example. So, web client Windows meta file invalid header size integer overflow. That's the attack. Well, this is free text. But what's this? Alert TCP external net from HTTP ports to home net any port. Flow from server established content. So it has a content field in hexadecimal D7CDC69A. And if you have this found in your traffic, if you have flow from server on the established connection, which is TCP, if the traffic is coming from the HTTP ports and which ports it is defined in this snort.conf, and is directed to homenet any port, then you have this attack. Okay, so that will match. Now, what about this class type attempted admin? Okay, I have generated an alert on this. But how dangerous it is, that's the question. And this says that it is very dangerous. Attempted admin has priority 1. So it requires immediate action. So the class type identifier in the rule, which is this, attempted admin, defines the relation between the detection rule and the prioritization rule. So this is the detection rule, and this is the prioritization rule. And this class type says our priority is this, attempted admin. Any detected attack classified as an attempted admin will have priority 1, because this is defined by the classification rule, this one, as it says one here. Now, you can override this. So, if we are not concerned with Windows metafile-related activity at all, because we don't use Windows metafiles, we don't use Windows at all, for example, but we want to keep priority one for other rules that have the same priority, then we can override the classification rule with the priority identifier. So we can say priority two. This overrides the class type attent admin priority, which is still one for other rules, but not for this one. That's the idea. We can, of course, override it for all the rules. Then we change the priority of attempted admin. But we didn't do that here. We did it only for this rule. So that was about priority. So you have seen that you can change the priority. You have the default configuration of these priorities. And you can do whatever you want with the rules that detect traffic and with the rules that define priorities. Okay, now we talk about distributed SNORT architecture. Now SNORT is slow. Why is it slow? Because it's a piece of software. So if you have gigabit network and you have a lot of traffic in this gigabit network, probably one sensor is not enough. So you have to separate traffic in such a way that one sensor analyzes the traffic that it can analyze. Not too much, because it will drop packets and you will have false negatives. Now, if you have a lot of sensors that detect attacks, then you have to make a system that gathers information from many sensors and manipulate this information, presents on the console, etc., etc. And we do this with distributed SNORT architecture. In such a way, we solve scalability problems. And this distributed SNORT architecture can be N-tier architecture with examples. One tier, a single host, governed by a single application. Or we can have departmental clusters. Or we can have typically a three-tier architecture on which we are going to focus. We have single tier, which is just hybrid sensor server, or we may have four tiers, but typically three. And here is a three-tier architecture. On the slide 203, we have a battery of sensors. In each sensor, you have SNORT installed. Okay, so this first tier is called the sensor tier. Now you have servers in this architecture. They receive alarms or alerts from these sensors. They may put them in some database. Or they may simply forward them to the console. Between the first tier, the sensor tier, and the second tier, the server tier, you typically have a firewall. And finally, you have the console tier that displays information from these servers. So this is a typical distributed three-tier SNORT architecture. You have sensors, you have servers, and you have an operator's console. On this console, you can run, for example, base. Now, on a large network, a SNORT sensor can be installed on any host, and there can be several such hosts. Then you will have a server, and this server will process information, which is alerts, actually, that are generated by the sensors. After some processing, usually filtering by the servers, information of high priority is sent immediately to the console. Of a bit lower priority, maybe a bit later, etc., etc. So what about the sensor tier, where the real intrusion monitoring takes place? So we have a sensor where you have installed SNORT, and this SNORT works as usual. So we have seen how one SNORT application works. It collects packets analyzes them against the rules files, and sends the generated alerts to the second tier. So, on each sensor you have a snort application that is run that interprets the nature of the collected packets and generates alerts. They don't do anything with these alerts. It is left to other tiers processing of the alerts. Servers, for example. Now, we have to place the sensors carefully in order to be able to process all the traffic that they need to process. Because otherwise, sensors may be evaded by dropping packets or by attacking against the sensors. Now, you configure the hosts that run sensor in a special way. They should run only snort and eventually some supporting applications, if any, and nothing else. Now, what to do if you have in cipher traffic and you want it to be monitored? Then snort must, of course, decrypt this traffic in order to be processed. But so processing must be done on the sensor machine. That's the idea. Why all that? Because running only snort and the supporting applications is more secure and more efficient. On such a host, only the ports used by snort are left active. So you have to configure this machine very carefully. Now, the sensor must have two network cards on it. One is the packet intercepting interface, where they really analyze traffic. So it is connected to the network that is monitored. And the interface communication with the server, for communication with the server, it's another network interface card that is used only for the communication with another network. All the intercepted packets arrive through the first interface. All the outgoing alerts are sent through the second interface. Unlike our router from the exercises, these two should not be connected for security reasons. Now, in addition to all that, the packet intercepting network interface card only listens. It doesn't have assigned an IP address, because otherwise you could, as an attacker, communicate with that interface card, attack it, etc. Of course, you can still do it if you know the MAC address. But for this, you have to physically access the network. So traffic can only flow in one direction, from the network to the network interface card. So that's this first network interface card that is used for analysis. In addition, well, and it is natural if we do not assign IP address to our card, we put it in promiscuous mode because it has to receive all the traffic. We said previously, not only traffic that is directed towards this IP address, but it doesn't have IP address, so all traffic by default. So this is called stealth mode. So it's a card that works, but without a binding IP address. So it still receives traffic, but it doesn't send any traffic. Why that? Security, of course. So it's not easily detected by an attacker. You cannot ping it, for example, etc., etc. But you can somehow discover its MAC address, and then it's finished, actually. You can do whatever with this. Now, of course, even without knowing the MAC address, you can attack the whole network segment, but you must have very, very powerful source of information. It's a typical automatic attack performed by a robot. Block whole network, whole segment. Overloading attacks or exploits that could cause the sensor to stop, but then it could for this to succeed, you must have some previous information that it has some vulnerability. Now, the other network interface card is connected to a separate network segment where we have servers. So that's management of Snort. It must have an IP address because they communicate with the second tier there and back, not only one way, because servers actually can configure the sensors. So they send new rules, for example, etc., etc. There have been many master theses, bachelor theses at this university that made applications. These are engineering projects. They made applications to configure Snort automatically. For example, upgrading Snort, introducing new alerts, etc., etc. New rules. So, alerts are sent out of this interface to the second tier, but also from the server, it is the other way around traffic that configures the sensors. So, upgrading the sensors, tuning Snort remotely by adding, removing, or modifying rules, adjusting preprocessor parameters, all that can be done remotely from the servers. And the management network is defended from the attacks coming from the outside by means of a firewall. This is nice if we have them, for example, all in Jovik. But if we have sensors in Jovik and the management in Trondheim, then it will be a bit more complicated. We don't use just a firewall. It must be much more protection. So that was about the sensors. The rest 3 minutes, we talk about the servers. So they receive alert data from the sensors, store them usually in some kind of database or some other forms, like syslog, but usually in database. Why that? Because then you can use queries and search, etc., etc., among the alerts. And you can present them in a nice way, this data. The graphical user interfaces, they are used on the database, and they are usually done, this monitoring in graphical tools is usually done on consola, but the data for that consola is on the servers. Now, servers have to be hardened because they actually contain a lot of sensitive and confidential information. For example, what is of high priority alert to you? So this is something that an attacker should not know. Something like that. So if an attacker takes control of the Snort server, the whole IDS can be stopped and an attack against the monitor network could pass unnoticed. That's the idea. That's why we configure the Snort server in such a way that the minimum number of services are installed on it and it gets minimum privileges necessary for its operation. Each Snort server runs a web server, so we have to update the web server software regularly. Okay, we stop here. Next time we finish with console tier and then we talk about adjustment of Snort. So Snort is a lot of story, and then we have Zeek and Suricata. Zeek is also pretty much story, and Suricata is almost nothing because Suricata conceptually is the same as Snort. Nothing special there, just implementation. Okay, that would be all for today.
So how does the sensor tier communicate, the one without an IP, communicates with the one that is connected to the server?
Interesting. I was not in the Blackboard room. I always forget something. Okay. They will have a recording of all the class from Omnum, hopefully. That's why it is good being physically present in the class. Okay, so what was your question? Sorry.
Yeah, you said the sensors, they are two. One that is not having an IP,
mm-hmm.
facing the traffic,
mm-hmm.
and the other one that is connected to...
two sellers, yes.
Yeah, so how do these two sensors communicate?
Through Snort. So Snort gets the information from the first kind of interface cards, produces alerts, and these alerts are sent to the servers through this second interface card. So there is no direct connection between these two network interface cards. Yeah. Okay. Ah, this is the problem. I lost the internet connection here. So that was the problem. So there was a technical problem. It was not me forgetting to start recording. Okay, for those that are still online, probably nobody. But, well, so there was a technical problem with Blackboard. Hopefully there was not a problem with Omnom, in which case you still did not lose any recording. So that's why we do two things in parallel each time. Okay, it's always something. Tomorrow we install Snort and play with it in the class.
No problem. We have to, but if not, then we just have to repeat the part three.